Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we hear from the man who hopes to unseat Congressman Devin Nunes. But does political newcomer Andrew Janz have a chance as a Democrat in one of the most solidly red districts in the San Joaquin Valley? We'll hear what he has to say on everything from healthcare to water. We'll also learn what K-12, community college, and university leaders are doing in Kern County that's getting people's attention. They call it the Kern Promise, but Bakersfield College President Sonia Christian calls it the path to revitalizing the community. Plus, a look at new exhibits at the Fresno Art Museum and more. We begin, though, with a national issue that has touched down in a big way in the mountains of Central California. Last month, President Donald Trump signed an executive order putting 20-plus national monuments across the country under review, including Giant Sequoia National Monument in the mountains of Tulare County. FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports that 17 years after it was created, its future existence is now in question.
Carla Clower fell in love with giant sequoias as a kid, riding horseback through the forest. We're sitting on a log under the canopy of her favorite grove of giant sequoias in the monument, Belknap Grove.
Well, this place is really my heart's home. It's where I feel connection to the earth and to nature. I'm hoping that human beings will treasure it.
The 74-year-old's family homesteaded in the area, and she's fought to keep the 33 groves in the monument safe for decades. Clower doesn't think the monument needs to be reviewed and says if it loses its status, giant sequoias could be in danger.
Opening up these lands to commodity extraction, I believe, is the motive. Prior to the designation of the monument, these forests right here where you're sitting were in what they call the timber base.
In the executive order President Trump signed last month, he asked Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke to look into a variety of things. Things like, are the monuments too big? Do they hurt the economy? And do people like them? The 328,000-acre Giant Sequoia National Monument was designated by former President Bill Clinton in 2000 and is split between two areas. The northern portion is near Kings Canyon National Park, and the southern part is near Sequoia National Forest. The Forest Service manages the monument. But what's really at risk here? Part of the fear of those opposing the review is that if its status is lost, it could open the door for logging or mineral exploration. They wouldn't be cutting down 2,000-year-old giant sequoias. And right now, there's no commercial logging happening here, but they are cutting down trees killed by bark beetles around homes, roads, and campsites.
He's coming down slow! Away from the road!
Critics fear without the monument, the entire area could be opened up to logging. Even if the sequoias themselves aren't cut down, environmental advocates like Carla Clower say logging could still destroy the ecosystem here.
You drive a bulldozer around the sequoias and you make it hotter and drier. You change the microclimate. And I say that you really have ensured the demise of those trees.
The president wouldn't have to get rid of all the monument. He could rezone the boundaries of the monument for separate uses like logging. How the forest is managed is a big part of the controversy over the monument. Eric LaPrice is a district ranger for the Western Divide Ranger District in Springville. He says his crews haven't focused on thinning out dead trees near sequoia groves recently because of lack of resources. Even though he says the dead trees increase the risk of wildfire around the groves.
We had to prioritize. That does not mean we're forgetting about those areas that are not a direct threat to the public. Even though we have not been able to actively thin around the groves, we have been able to manage some fire on the landscape.
Not everyone likes the idea, There have been several lawsuits over the monument, including one involving Tulare County Supervisor Steve Worthley. He says he doesn't think the Forest Service manages it well, and says he explained that to Interior Secretary Zinke a few weeks ago on a trip to Washington.
The monument has been a failure on the part of the Forest Service to administer the mission, which would be the protection of giant sequoias. You'll see a lot of dead trees surrounding the groves.
Worthley says the giant sequoias should be protected, but he doesn't think they have to be within a monument to do so. He says the creation of the monument hurt the local economy, and says he wouldn't mind if areas of it were open for activities like logging.
It had that effect of destroying an industry that had been in place since 1949. Since then, the Forest Service has taken basically a passive approach to forest management, which means do nothing.
But what happens if the Secretary of Interior recommends the president drop the monument status? Does President Trump really even have the authority to remove the status?
There is not any precedent in history of a president acting through his executive authority, revoking a national monument.
That's Bob Keiter. He's a specialist in public lands law at the University of Utah College of Law. He says if a president does that, it may present a legal problem because of the Antiquities Act, which gives a president the right to create a monument, doesn't say much about the president stripping a monument of its status.
It does not include that authority because Congress didn't give it to him. There's the power to create, but not the power to modify or revoke monument designations.
Keiter says if the secretary recommends a status loss, it would result in lawsuits and could take up to 5 years to change and maybe even require a congressional vote.
The question is whether or not that sort of power could be inferred from the Antiquities Act, because it's certainly not given to the president explicitly in the Constitution.
We reached out to the Department of Interior, but didn't get a response to our request for an interview. Back in the monument under the trees along the middle fork of the Tule River, Carla Clower says she's not going to let her decades of defending these ancient giants go to waste.
I will keep fighting. If the worst comes to pass, there will be a whole new generation of others that will fight, because if they undo the Sequoia Monument, there are many other national monuments and parks that they'll be after next.
In the meantime, as the monuments are being reviewed, the public can weigh in by filing comments until July 10th. In a press release, both the secretary and the president say they strongly believe that local input is a critical component of federal land management. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
And you can find a link on our website about how to comment on the future of the giant sequoia national monument. This is Valley Edition. When local school districts aren't performing, parents typically turn to school boards or PTAs to bring about change. But in a small Fresno County city, education advocates are thinking bigger, trying to enact what FM89's Carrie Klein reports is a much bolder and more ambitious kind of transformation.
It's 8 a.m. in the city of Huron, and the Chevron on Lassen Avenue is bumping. Between drivers filling their tanks, cashier Lydia Ramirez serves kids loading their backpacks with breakfast burritos, candy, and pizza.
$1. There you go.
Thank you. Thank you.
These kids are on their way to the middle school down the street. But high school students, Ramirez says, they hardly ever come in.
I don't see them in the morning. I mean, they have to get their bus. They have to get up early.
Her 16-year-old daughter is one of them. She wakes up at 5 a.m. for a bus ride that lasts over an hour. Her high school is 20 miles away in Kalinga. The city share the Kalinga-Huron Unified School District. Ramirez says it'll be a relief when her daughter graduates.
And it's like my last daughter. I'm like, I'm almost out. You know, she doesn't have to get up early.
Ramirez isn't the only one who's frustrated. Hundreds of Huron parents are. And it's not just the commute. School performance is low and students are dropping out. So Huron's parents came up with a plan. Break away from Kalinga and create their own school district. It's a long shot, but the state could approve the new district later this summer, a decision Ramirez would support.
Oh, heck yeah. Even though if my kid's not in high school anymore, I would, because I suffered that when I went to high school. You know, everybody did.
Huron's tiny. Blink and you've driven through it. Primarily an ag town, it's one of the poorest cities in California. Almost 100% of its 7,000 residents are Latino. Kalinga, home to 17,000 residents, feels more suburban. It's bigger, whiter, and more affluent, even though both cities are poorer than the state as a whole. These differences are one reason Ben Silva says it's time to secede.
you know, our future is not going to be left to somebody else. It's going to be left to us. And that's the point of it.
Ben Silva is chairman of the so-called Huron Reorganization Committee. Huron has an elementary and middle school, but Kalinga has the high school. Silva says 12 years ago, Huron tried to build its own high school, but the Kalinga Majority School Board voted it down. That's when Huron said, let's just do this ourselves. The committee circulated a petition to create Huron Unified, and it got far more than the 250 signatures it needed.
2 weeks after turning them in, we still had people coming up wanting to sign. We were like, well, it's already gone. We got enough. But when it's time to vote, we'll remember you.
The state gives the current school district low grades, and online rankings place it in the bottom 5% of the state. Its dropout rate is higher than the state average, too. Silva argues Huron's high schoolers can do better closer to home.
These kids aren't going to Harvard. If you had every kid going to Ivy League, you wouldn't hear from us. There's a reason that we have to be engaged.
Huron advocates also claim their schools don't receive their fair share of district funding, and their kids get fewer opportunities than Kalinga's. Both the superintendent's office and the school board refused interviews for this story. So how do Kalinga residents feel about all this? I walked around downtown to find out. The handful of parents I spoke to said they'd never heard of the discrimination the Huron committee claims. One even said Huron students receive special treatment. Even so, those who had heard of the proposed split generally support it. Vanessa Rodriguez, a Kalinga mother of eight, says it comes down to her perception of crime.
I think it'd be better for them because it'd be less gang violence around Kalinga. You got the Huron kids that come and do trouble. They're the ones that mostly influence the other kids around here.
Laura Cajero Bemis, getting her hair done in a Kalinga salon, supports it for a different reason.
I think that it would be a good thing for Huron and the community. Doing that, they'd be open to more grants available and to help grow the community.
The State Department of Education will give the plan a thumbs up or down in July. If it moves forward, spokesman Robert Oakes says it'll go up for a vote in the next election.
This is a local decision. Starts at the local level, ends at the local level. We're in the middle. Once anything happens here or doesn't happen here, it's back to the voters this started with. It's democracy in action.
School district reorganizations don't happen very often. In the last 20 years, only 2 of 13 requests made it past the state in local elections in all of California. New districts need to check a lot of boxes. They need enough students to be viable. They also have to prove they can afford it while still delivering quality education. The Huron committee says they've got all that covered. But there is one potential point of weakness.
You also cannot discriminate or promote racial or ethnic segregation.
Because Huron and Kalinga are so racially different, the resulting school districts would be more segregated than the current one, though they're all still majority Latino. Is that more important than school performance or local identity? The state will decide. Then, maybe even the voters. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Across the Central Valley, almond orchards bloom in late winter. Beehives are brought in for pollination, but this year in Fresno County, something went wrong. Now county ag officials are investigating the deaths of hundreds of thousands of honeybees. Capital Public Radio's Julia Mitrich has the story.
Tom Ullman's an old hand at California agriculture, but he's new to honeybee forensics.
The Kerman District Office got the call. A gentleman was driving past and saw some dead bees. I'll show you where the colonies were.
Ullman works for the Fresno County Agricultural Commissioner. He's part of an investigation into 2 large bee kills. One happened here in Kerman. Ullman turns his pickup into a muddy lane between 2 almond orchards.
It's right about here were the ones that we came out and took samples from.
They collected bee bodies and swabs from outside the hives and sent them to a lab at the California Department of Pesticide Regulation. Ullman's looked over pesticide use reports in Kerman for the days leading up to the bee kill.
And so far there's nothing that has been done that we have found that is in violation of any regulatory requirements according to the label.
About those labels, California has safeguards in place for honeybees. Here's how they work. Certain pesticide labels carry warnings of the risk to bees when the product is sprayed on blooming crops, like this one.
Do not apply this product to blooming crops or weeds if bees are visiting the treatment area.
Gene Brandy is president of the American Beekeeping Federation and a veteran beekeeper from Los Banos. He says the label is the law. Everybody gets that what's written on the label means do not apply these pesticides by day. And Brandy says, remember the backdrop, the Central Valley in late winter.
It's very likely that there's going to be some bees visiting blooming plants if you've got blooming plants on your property, especially if you've got almonds within 2 miles.
Brandy reckons growers, pesticide applicators, and beekeepers all clearly understand following the label to mean only apply these pesticides at night.
This is added 10 years to my life, what happened this year.
Joe Treanor's been wrangling bees for nearly 50 years. Hives he brought to Kerman got hit. Bees he put in Sanger orchards, 30 miles east, were hit even worse. To Treanor, the volume of dead bees and their location suggests exposure to a pesticide, the kind with a bee warning. He suspects a spray was applied into the early morning hours. USDA lab reports show several insecticides in bee bodies and bee pollen from Kerman. One of them is Carzol, commonly used by nectarine growers to control an insect called thrips. In both bee kill areas, there are nectarines within 3 miles of almonds. The county's preliminary finding is that a Carzol application to nearby nectarines was completed by midnight.
I can't totally blame the county.
Bee broker Joe Treanor.
They depend on use reports, and use reports are only good as the honesty of the guy that signs them, saying what he put on, what time of day he put it on, and anybody can fudge a use report.
Stace Leone, Fresno County Deputy Ag Commissioner, is leading the investigation. Yes, she says it's an honor system, but she doesn't find it credible that pesticide applicators would intentionally break the rules.
Why would you want to spend money on a product and apply it if it wasn't going to work, or do it at the wrong time or use too much? That doesn't make sense to me why they would do that.
Bee broker Joe Treanor says he won't bring bees back into these areas next year unless the county can assure him this won't happen again.
I want them to pay more attention to what's going on in their county and establish some kind of rules that can be enforced.
A lot of statements are being made that we don't care.
Stace Leone.
Or we're not turning over all stones to try to figure it out. That's just not true.
While the county investigation follows its course, beekeepers impacted by this winter's bee kills are working on regenerating their colonies. In Sacramento, I'm Julia Mitrich.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. California's 22nd congressional district is known as rock-solid Republican country. Spanning Tulare and Fresno counties, Republicans there hold a 10% voter registration edge. And in the last three election cycles, Tulare's Devin Nunes has won commandingly each time, with 67, 72, and 61% of the vote, respectively. The chair of the House Intelligence Committee, Nunes has recently become the subject of national attention after his involvement with the House investigation into Russian hacking of the campaign of Hillary Clinton. Now with the election just a year and a half away, Nunes has already drawn a Democratic challenger, current Fresno County Deputy District Attorney Andrew Jantz, who joins us today. Andrew, let me start with this. Walk me through the process of how you decided to jump into politics. You told the Fresno Bee that until recently you had not considered a political future. How did you go about making this decision?
Sure. I'm a lifelong resident of the Valley. I've lived in the district for most of my life. My father worked in factories. My mom worked in a hospital. So I grew up in a very normal working class family home. My dad served in the Peace Corps and instilled within me at a very young age the importance of public service. So he's been a big part of my life and, you know, basically got me involved in public service. That's why I'm a DA. Part of my job is to be out there and advocating for public safety and for the rights of victims. You know, we've seen over the last couple of weeks and months that the congressman hasn't been meeting with his voters. And that really pushed me to get involved. I think that the people of the district deserve a representative that's going to sit down with them and talk to them about the issues that affect them, the issues that are most important to them. And that person needs to go to Washington and represent those values and interests. So that's why I decided to jump in.
Have you been involved in active party politics here locally before, or is this also new for you in that sense?
This is all new to me. I'm not a career politician, but I'll say this. I've been involved in the community. My wife, she's involved in the community as well. She owns a small business here in town. So we're out and about. We meet a lot of folks, and they're all concerned about what's going on in Washington and about the representation that our congressman's providing, or lack thereof.
So why run? You kind of alluded to it a little bit in your criticism of the congressman regarding the town halls, but I take it that it's deeper than that?
Sure. He's not doing his job. We need somebody that's going to go to Washington and go to bat for the folks that live in California 22. And we haven't seen that for the last 10 or so years. The congressman is pretty open about it. He's written and talked about himself being in a safe district. What we're here to do, and by the way, we're working with voters from all political spectrums, Democrats, Independents, Republicans. We're talking to everybody, and everyone's equally concerned. And we just want to make sure that the congressman is held accountable and that he no longer feels that he has a safe seat that allows him to go and basically advance his own political agenda without thinking about the hardworking folks that live back here at home.
One of the issues that has proven to be controversial, of course, just in the last 2 weeks, the vote on the American Health Care Act, all of California's congressional Republicans supported that bill that significantly changes the provisions that Congress laid out under the Affordable Care Act. It could result in many millions losing health insurance coverage they now have. It's easy to critique that from the outside, but if you were in Washington, what would you want to see in a bill, in a health care bill? Or is it just status quo with the Affordable Care Act as it is?
Sure. I think there was a poll out recently that said about 60% of Americans think that the Affordable Care Act should be protected and or improved upon. And that's my position. I'm going to go to Washington and make sure that pre-existing conditions continue to be covered. I'm going to go to Washington to make sure that this age tax that's included within this new bill is not a part of the health care discussion. I'm going to go to Washington and fight to make sure that, as I said before, pre-existing conditions are covered. One of the worst parts of the bill, I think, is the fact that women, the fact that you're a woman, is basically being treated as a pre-existing condition in itself. So there's a lot of issues that the people here are concerned with. And again, I've talked to people from all different political spectrums, Republicans, Independents, and Democrats, and they all agree that this piece of legislation that the congressman voted on last week, which, by the way, he did so without holding a single town hall or meeting with any constituents, not one of these folks that I've met with support this piece of legislation. So we need really a champion in Washington that's going to be an advocate for the people.
Part of running for office is raising money. As being someone who's new to politics, I imagine fundraising is something that you're also new to on at least on a political level. How do you realistically go about that and try to mount a serious campaign? As we've seen Democratic challengers in the past not fare too well come November. How do you go about raising the type of funding necessary to make this a serious race?
Sure. Like you mentioned, I'm not a politician. I've never done any fundraising before. But I can tell you this. There's a lot of excitement out there. There's a lot of energy. And there's a lot of folks that have gotten involved, both financially and support-wise on the ground. And we're looking forward to posting big numbers coming up by the end of June.
Before Representative Nunes got a national reputation on this Russia issue and the Intelligence Committee, he was primarily known for his advocacy here locally on issues of water. The Democratic Party has been strongly opposed in large part to his efforts to change the restrictions on water exports from the Delta to this part of the state and change the Endangered Species Act. If you were in Congress, would you pursue a similar agenda to Representative Nunes? Or would you be more in line with what Democrats in the House have generally been supporting?
Sure. I'm glad you brought this issue up because water is one of the most important issues for the region. I had mentioned in previous interviews that over the next few months we're going to be going on a listening tour, and we're going to be meeting with experts. We're going to be meeting with local governments. We're going to be meeting with farmers, people who own land, environmentalists. We're going to be meeting with everybody. As we all know, water is a complicated issue, but I'd say this. Devin Nunes has made a number of promises in relation to water over the last 10 years. I don't think he's fulfilled any of his promises. And while we're on the topic of water, there's a number of water-related issues that are being totally ignored right now, you know, especially in some of the outlying regions of our county and our region, unincorporated cities. We have an issue, a real issue, with clean drinking water. There are some statistics that show that some of our drinking water is some of the worst in the nation, rivaling that in Flint, Michigan. That's not being talked about by the congressman. We have our groundwater supplies is completely gone. And, you know, the governor said we're out of a drought, but we still have a long way to go until we get back on track. So I think we need to have another we need to push for legislation and laws and policies that will re-energize some of the groundwater aquifers that we've seen been decimated over the last several years. So, you know, I'd point out this, that Devin Nunes likes to tout himself as a water expert, but I would argue that the region's water security has gotten worse, not better, over the last 10 years under his leadership.
You're currently a deputy DA with the Fresno County DA's office specializing in violent crimes. Are you still on the job there? Are you taking a leave of absence? What's going on with that side of your employment?
Sure, I'm still on the job. I'm working my 8 to 5 hours and then working on campaign stuff afterwards.
As a prosecutor, law and order is one thing that elected officials have to deal with. We've heard many people, including local law enforcement, local criminal justice folks, talk about the effects that criminal justice reform has had in California. We're talking realignment, Prop 47, Prop 57, Sheriff Mims, Chief Dyer, even D.A. Smitkamp have talked about what they perceive as a cause and effect relationship between some of those policies and an increase in crime. Have you seen that, and how do you view criminal justice law and public safety issues from an elected from someone who's seeking elected office?
Sure, that's a good question. You know, I'd say this. Some of the effects of some of the pieces of legislation that we've been talking about, Prop 47, Prop 57, I think the effects of those are sort of going to be figured out in the long run. I think it's too soon to see really how those pieces of legislation have really affected the criminal justice system. I'm someone that firmly believes that our criminal justice system isn't perfect, but we're always, especially those that work within the system, we're always striving to make sure that it's better, it's more just, and it's more fair. You know, we're taking a wait-and-see approach right now with regard to that. You know, some of the things that that we're talking about with regard to the campaign, you know, people are concerned about public safety. And I think that in part relates to some of this discussion that we've seen about immigration. And I think the police chief, Chief Dyer, came out. And I think also the mayor, Mayor of Fresno, Lee Brand, talked about how immigration and some of the stuff that's going on in Washington affects our ability as, you know, prosecutors and people who investigate and prosecute crimes. The effects of some of the talk in Washington that has on being able to, you know, get witnesses to court, having them testify and getting them justice. A lot of people are concerned that, you know, if they show up or if they report crimes, that they might be prosecuted themselves or deported. And so that's something that we're focusing on. We want to make sure that people that are victims of crime have an ability to come forward and report what's going on with them.
You're talking about visas for foreign nationals who report crimes. That is something that is an issue. Also, under the Obama administration, President Obama had made civil rights a big issue, especially with regards to the tension that we had seen throughout communities and policing practices. President Trump's budget significantly makes cuts to those sorts of programs. In a time when, in many cases, in many communities, faith in law enforcement, especially among communities of color, is a big concern. From your perspective as a prosecutor and your perspective as somebody who's running for office, what do you think the federal government's role in trying to address that issue is? And what would you like to see there?
Sure. You know, I think during the presidential campaign, the president tried to tout himself sort of as the pro-law enforcement guy. You know, I think that, you know, it's a shame that some of these programs are being eliminated under his proposed budget. I think that this is a time and age where our men and women who serve need our support, both federally and locally. So I'd be opposed to any types of cuts to any, you know, law enforcement agency over the issue of politics. So I'd like to see some of those community-based policing efforts expanded upon. I think that there are studies that show that they help reduce crime and engender trust between law enforcement and the public in the long run.
Andrew Janz is running for California's 22nd Congressional District, challenging Tulare Republican incumbent Devin Nunes for the 2018 election. It may seem like a long ways away, but that clock is ticking, only 500 and something days away. Andrew Janz, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Joe.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment and learn more about what's happening with the Kern Promise, something that Bakersfield College President Sonia Christian says could revitalize the community, plus new exhibits at the Fresno Art Museum. It's all coming up on Valley Edition. This is Valley Edition. This past weekend, students of Bakersfield College had a big reason to celebrate. It was commencement, the 103rd in the history of the community college. Some students will go on to take their associate degrees into the workforce, while others will transfer to CSUB or to other four-year colleges and universities. But on a campus where 80% of the student body is made up of first-generation college students, how do you increase the graduation rate and ensure that students actually get their degree? There's some news on that front. Here to tell us more is Bakersfield College President Sonia Christian, joining us now on Valley Public Radio. Sonia, welcome.
Well, thank you, Joe.
First off, congratulations to the graduates of the class of 2017. But moving on to this new thing called the Kern Promise, we talked with Horace Mitchell about this a while ago, but more details have come out since then. Exactly what is this new effort that brings together Kern High Schools, you at BC, and also CSUB? What are you trying to accomplish here?
I am so excited that the collaboration in our community around the recognition that education is what is going to revitalize and grow our community from an economic perspective, from a social engagement perspective, everyone sort of locking arms together to ensure that students complete their associate's degree and they transfer. So what is the Kern Promise? The first operational aspect is that BC will work with the Kern High School District to make sure students are college ready when they come to BC. What does college ready mean? We're looking at English and math. So if they're college ready, we're saying that the student and Bakersfield College need to enter into a contract, a shared responsibility model to get students through and to CSUB in 2 years or 60 credits. So that's our transfer focus. The second aspect of the Kern Promise is the financial aspect, because California, in one way, I'm so proud of California, because you may not know, I went to Oregon for 10 years and then I came back to Bakersfield College. And when you look at our tuition, it's very affordable in California. It's $46 per college credit. But even saying that, with the low tuition, and we have a Board of Governors, the California Community College Board of Governors P waiver, that if a student is in need, the tuition gets waived, and we have federal financial aid. After you do all that, there's still need. Our students have need in terms of their books, transportation. So the Bakersfield College Foundation is looking at providing scholarships for those pieces of cost that a student incurs going full-time to college. So that is going to be a huge part of the current promise. Down the line, we're going to expand the current promise to include students who are not ready for college-level English and math as well. But this is sort of the first step that we're taking.
You mentioned that college readiness, remedial education, has been a concern of educators in the CSU and community colleges for well over two decades now. With the requirements that K through 12 education has right now in the state and in the nation, is there the flexibility to try to make the changes at those levels to improve those rates of the students who don't need remedial education? Because in many cases, it's more students that need it than don't. What changes are you seeing at the lower levels to get those students ready for BC?
Yes, there's been significant amount of focused and targeted work in getting students college ready, be it at CSUB or Bakersfield College. A big method of approaching it is called pathways. So we are looking at students who come in at the ninth grade. So we're not waiting until the 12th grade or waiting for students to come to college and then testing them and saying, oh, by the way, you have to take remedial level math or English. We're starting right with a big campaign right at the ninth grade to get students selecting courses that in the 10th grade, the 11th grade, and 12th grade, we can get those courses taken care of at the high school. Because this is not only a smart move from a learning perspective, but it's also a smart move from an economic perspective. Because if the students are ready, college ready, then we don't have to spend money on remedial education at the university or the community college. So the whole guided pathways approach that BC has been taking is showing remarkable improvements. And already, we've only implemented it in the last several years. And if you look at the percentage of students being placed into college level in math and English, we're already showing improvement. So I am confident that over the next 5 to 8 years, we're going to see a significant number of students coming college ready. The other piece I would mention in the context of guided pathways is dual enrollment. We have a great collaboration with Kern High School District, and for that matter, even with Delano and McFarland, to get students to take college level classes in the 11th and the 12th grade. So that way, when they have a transcript that says Bakersfield College and they've got a course taken care of, research shows that they're more likely to get into college. So there are multiple points of connection between Kern High School District and BC that is truly making an improvement in getting students college ready.
What about once they get to BC, ensuring that they actually progress through to get that AA degree? I know in some cases, some students take a long time and they take up a lot of space in college that other students might need. What are you doing on that front to try to move students along in a fashion that gets them a degree and gets them on to the next level?
That's a great question. In fact, what we're looking at is how do we keep students to stay on their path to graduation or to transfer? And some of the specific areas are looking at how faculty in disciplines like a biology faculty or a math faculty, rather than focusing on just being discipline experts, how do they get students to do their tutoring at Bakersfield College? Because if we get students to go back home to do their homework, again, because they're first generation, they have so many competing responsibilities, we don't get students to do their homework to the level that they need to the first go around and not the second or the third or the fourth. And then they've accumulated 85 credits to get an associate's degree rather than 60 credits. So we are looking at ways in which the academic side, that are the discipline faculty, are working hand in hand with our tutoring programs, with our supplemental instruction, to make sure that in the syllabus, students are accounting for 5 to 6 hours of spending time in our tutoring center, working on their writing, working on their math, so that they can be successful the first time around. And another piece I must mention is that if students come to BC that are not college ready, in the past, we would have them go 4 levels below college and working on arithmetic and then progressing to college level math. And now we're saying, you know, wait a minute. We want to get them as quickly as possible to accelerate them through and into college level math as soon as we can. We've come up with a redesign of the curriculum to get students using contextualized problem solving to get their quantitative math skills. And then we put them into their college level math class along with tutoring. So the tutoring becomes almost mandatory for students to do. It's not go home and do your homework, but guess what? This is going to be a boot camp. You're going to do your homework here on our campus with student tutors and faculty hanging out so that they can help you with that.
Of course, students also need facilities, and that is a big subject of your time right now. Last fall, Kern voters approved a $503 million bond measure for the Kern Community College District. How far are we along in the spending plan and the planning to actually build some of these improvements and renovations?
Everyone who's listening, thank you so much for passing Measure J. We were required to pass it by 55%, but we got over 65% that passed it. So thank you. We are all set to start spending the money right away. In fact, our district came up with a very creative financing, which cut down the interest rate on those bonds. So we sell the bonds and we immediately spend it. And then we go in and sell the next set rather than selling them and then incurring interest over a 30-year period. And that was one of the reasons why Kern Tax supported that bond measure. The other piece that we were not anticipating is there was a statewide bond measure, Proposition 51, that was passed as well. So we're now regrouping and being really smart that for our STEM building, we're going to be using our own local funds, but we want to leverage the Proposition 51 so our local funds can go deeper. We will be launching our Veterans Resource Center right away. It's about a 2,000 to 3,000 square foot space that would be dedicated for our student veterans. Our student veteran population is approximately 600 and growing, and this will provide tutoring services and other counseling support services for our student veterans. One of our signature projects is our STEM building. So our STEM program is a program that is growing in leaps and bounds. And again, we're focusing on rural Kern to bring students into high-wage jobs. So Measure J is going to be providing additional laboratory spaces for our biology and our chemistry students. We're highly impacted. And in fact, we refer students to our neighboring colleges to pick up their STEM requirements because we're really maxed out. It's also going to be providing spaces for student support so they can be successful in those classes. So we're starting the architectural designs for the STEM building. We've got many more signature projects. Our agriculture is a focus and our student support services are a focus as well.
Bakersfield College President Sonia Christian joining us today on Valley Edition, talking about how the college is putting Measure J to work for Bakersfield College and also new efforts known as the Kern Promise to guarantee a pathway in and out of Bakersfield College for area students. Sonia Christian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. There's a set of new exhibits opening this weekend at the Fresno Art Museum, including three featuring the works of Fresno artists. Here to tell us more, we have Michelle Ellis-Pracy of the Fresno Art Museum joining us in our studio. Michelle, welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Three of these exhibits, as I mentioned, focus on the works of artists with ties to Fresno or artists who live in Fresno, and three different sorts of backgrounds as well. With Nancy Odelman and then another exhibit by Leslie Batty and also Maurice Cohen. Let's go ahead and start with those three. Give us a little preview of what each of those might all be all about.
Okay. I've been in Fresno now 2 years and 2 months, and one of my focuses has always been to bring in Fresno-based artists because I think we hadn't done that for a while. And I'd heard grumblings about that from the artist community. So finally, with this season, the summer season, I'm able to showcase three Fresno-based artists. Two are well-known in the community, and one is better known as a professor of science and mathematics, retired from Fresno State. So both Leslie Batty and Nancy Odelman have a feminist bent to their purpose for making art. Nancy Odelman is having a retrospective covering 50 years. Leslie Batty is presenting brand new paintings for this exhibition that are very subtly politically charged, both about feminism and about society today and government, etc. And then Maurice spends half his year in Fresno and half in Paris, but he paints only in Fresno. And he's an impressionist, so he's very traditional in the art that he creates, but he's magnificent with it. And he was recommended to me. We made a studio visit, and he has his exhibition.
Yeah, how do you find someone like that? I've heard of Nancy's work and Leslie Batty's work as well over the years. Have not come across Maurice Cohen.
Correct.
And he's a mathematics professor, you said?
Mathematics and science, and he's still works with UC Berkeley, and we will have several of his books on exhibit along with his paintings. He's a phenomenal mind, and he came to me as a reference. And so I had photographs to look at, and I read about his background, and I thought, this looks like a very interesting man. So I met he and his wife, and we looked at a lot of different paintings and selected the ones that are on view now.
When it comes to working with someone like Leslie Batty, who's coming up with new work, especially for this exhibit, how does that relationship work as a curator and as the artist? What's the dialogue like there? Do you say, Leslie, I would like you to do this, or let's do something that's contemporary issues, and then she takes it from there, or do you just give her a blank slate? How do you go about coming up with the concept?
Well, actually, Christina Hornback, who is the curator at the museum, I'm the chief curator, but she is the curator for the Leslie Batty exhibition. And basically, we invited her to have a solo show and gave her this time frame. Fortunately, she's on sabbatical this year, so she doesn't have the teaching to interfere with the painting. And basically, she had free rein. We said, you are a terrific painter. You are well-known in Fresno. You are becoming better known other places. And we would like you to do an exhibition of brand new work. And then Christina has gone to her studio probably four times for conversations and direction. And so they massaged each other through the process because it is brand new work. So we have not asked her to do anything in particular.
And also those two exhibits you mentioned, both of them have a feminist bent. Also, maybe sort of bookends in terms of the legacy of feminist artists from Fresno going all the way back to Judy Chicago.
Absolutely. One of the most impressive things about the Fresno Art Museum is that for 30 years, one of our auxiliary groups called the Council of 100 has selected a woman artist to be honored every year. And this has happened for 30 years. They're primarily from California because it's more reasonable to ship them in and raise the money for that. But one of the requirements of this honor is that they live 100 miles outside of Fresno. So a woman who meets all the criteria except for the distance outside the city cannot be an honored woman. So I chose Nancy to be honored because she deserves it. And she has a body of work that does span early feminism all the way through today and a different kind of feminism, but we couldn't be feminist today if it hadn't been for the 70s.
You also have an exhibit coming up here that is tied in some way to students at Fresno Unified and some curriculum that they had been working on.
Yes, we are almost a school during the regular work week. Monday through Friday, we have every single age group of child in our museum, from pre-kindergarten all the way up through high school. And every year, our Any Given Child program, which is devoted to third graders and supported by the Bonner Family Foundation in part, and the Unified School District now, and the Fresno County Office of Ed Foundation, they come in and they have a really in-depth experience at the museum, including classroom work in the museum and classroom work back at school. And we mount an exhibit of their work every year, and they bring their parents in, and we have a reception, and it's treated just like a regular museum exhibition. They have wall labels, and one child's work is selected out of every class for this show.
Sounds like a great opportunity to get kids interested in the world of art. You also have some new works in your permanent collection that are going on display.
Yes. Another thing I want the Fresno community to realize is that we are the keeper of five vaults of artwork for them that have been acquired by the museum by donation or with money for as long as we've existed, for 68 years. So this season is really devoted to what we have in Fresno and what the museum holds in good faith for the community. So we have new pieces that have been brought into the collection over the last few years that are stellar.
Now, the exhibits open on Saturday officially, but there's a preview on Friday. Tell us
yes,
about that.
The opening reception is Friday evening. It's from 6 to 8. However, the curators and the artists and the lenders to our exhibits meet at 4:30 in the Bonner Auditorium, and I lead a discussion. Each artist introduces themselves. The curators discuss why they created this exhibit and what it means for the museum and the community. And that lasts about an hour. Then the artists depart and go to their respective galleries and are available for one-on-one questions and answers just before the reception. So it's a marvelous opportunity to appreciate as fully as possible what we have on our walls.
In today's climate, and I mean that in every sense of the word, with all the different things that we have in front of us now with our smartphones and different distractions that are out there, let alone the economic climate and all those things, how challenging is it to keep a museum like this strong and is focusing on the local artists who have maybe a connection in the community? Is that an important part of the strategy moving forward? How do you keep an organization that's been around for 68 years vital and moving forward?
Well, it takes vision and it takes risk and it takes practicing. You know, what would this community like and be in terms of their art museum? And I came here not knowing anybody 2 years ago. So I've thrown myself into hearing not complaints, but suggestions of how to improve it. I have brought my own 30 years of museum professional experience. We have an incredible staff who are all museum professionals. There are only five of us, and I've got a great board. So I think this is a team effort, just like it is here. And when you're a nonprofit in a city where culture is not the priority, people want it and need it and love it. But to support it is always a challenge. And so we have our annual fund drives. They're out in the mail right now. That happens twice a year. We have a great appraisal day coming up at the end of March. I mean, at the end of May, May 31st, which is like Antiques Roadshow at the museum. And if you just go to our website, www.fresnoartmuseum.org, everything that we're doing right now, as well as into the future, is available on the website.
So, again, that's on the website. You can also find out exhibits, information on these new exhibits as well.
Absolutely. And future exhibits as well. We're booked all the way into 2019.
Wow.
That's
quite a
We're on a mission here. Yeah.
Well, it sounds very exciting, and we look forward to seeing those new exhibits that open up this weekend. Again, the preview event on Friday evening, and then Saturday, things are open for the summer season. Again, with us today, Michelle Ellis-Pracy of the Fresno Art Museum. What's the website again?
www.fresnoartmuseum.org.
All right. Well, we look forward to those exhibits, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the exposure.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us your comments via email, talk@kvpr.org. And also, if you're on social media, on Twitter, you can send us a tweet @KVPR and @Valley Edition. You can find our audio archives and podcast on our website. Also, our outdoorsy podcast, as well as this program, online at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. You're listening to Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, celebrating 20 years dedicated to advancing healthcare that works for all Californians. chcf.org.